Can I help you?
I'm sorry, my name is Fink. Bill asked me to drop by this afternoon. Is he, in?
Mr. Mayhew is indisposed at the moment.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to episode 7 of The Drunken Odyssey. It's been a perilous summer. We find ourselves water skiing, the tether line in our teeth, as we have a bomb we are trying to defuse in one arm and a pregnant sea lion in the other, when we notice a tentacle curling up out of the water, around a leg, upwards into our crotch, and then our cell phone rings. Between the botched economy, another station of what Hunter Thompson called the grim slide of American prosperity, and a general postmodern sense of domesticated exhaustion, actual travel during the summertime seems more like a penance than any kind of a reward or a way to rejuvenate one's spirit. People don't necessarily have the money to travel, and we are so dispirited that the idea of trying not to be exhausted and miserable just seems like too much effort, like a bad risk. At least that might help explain my horror at the new word in the English language, a staycation. Ick. Last weekend, I saw the Palm Beach Shakespeare Festival's production of Twelfth Night. It was a rather long drive to get down from Central Florida to Jupiter, always longer than I anticipate, though less than the planet Jupiter would take, I imagine. I felt transformed by the end of the night. After seeing the show, then driving back into the night, the white lines of the turnpike and ellipses inside my brain as John Coltrane throws lariats of sound into the heavens. The production of Twelfth Night, starring and directed by Kevin Crawford, who was my guest on episode 3, emphasized the trauma of the catastrophe that occurs before the play. I don't want to spoil it for you, since if you live in South Florida, you could still catch it this weekend, showtime at 8 at Carlin Park in Jupiter. Stay until the end if you go. It translates you into the stars. Elsewhere on that same night, my friend Yaroslav took a tumble and split his lip enough to require 17 stitches. I don't know if this was a drunken tumble or just one of those inexplicable malfeasances of fate, but I wish him a speedy recovery. Yaroslav was on last week's show. I don't know if I've properly introduced him, since I moved back to Florida 2 years ago from the literary ether of New York. He's been my literary confessor, colleague, and conspirator. He has worked in the office of the Department of Writing and Rhetoric here at the University of Central Florida. He's younger than I am, he's 24 or so, and in some sort of symbiosis, in a few weeks he'll be moving to New York to begin an MFA in fiction writing at NYU, 2 years after I finished mine. I am proud to pass him the bottle, or the baton, whatever. In our last conversation, we talked a little bit about how the vision of a writer's reality in our culture is ironically defined by the movies. So that is what we're talking about today, and we're joined by Lisa Roney, who once taught a class on the subject that she called Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know. Odd Lord Byron wasn't in any of our film picks. My especially short story, The Confessions of Guy Psycho, Installment 1, has been tentatively accepted by Jason Croft at Bachelor Pad Magazine. I do need to revise the story a smidgen, which I have not yet had time to undertake, which is really, really sad. The story is 631 words. Also on today's show, Elise Hamilton talks about Francesca Leah Block's Dangerous Angels. All right, let's get Yaroslav and Lisa in here.
And now, the interview of the day.
So I have with me right now Lisa Claire Roney and Yaroslav Kalfar for a summit discussion of movies about writers, which might sound counterintuitive to any purists out there. Why talk about films about writers? That's like listening to rap music about ballet. What is more, film and its hydra-headed bastard television is often credited with a perceived decline in reading, a fear we have heard hysterically fretted about
for about a century. It just seemed like our conception of what writing means and what writing means for so many people is based on what we see in the movies where we don't have to read. And I thought it might be fun just to go through what we think about a lot of these different movies. And so we had an intense negotiation about which movies would go on the list. I think we finally agreed on a fairly good sampling of relevant, important movies with a couple of Dark Horse candidates in there. I'd like to begin by talking about Barton Fink, the 1991 film by the Coen brothers. I think that Barton Fink is the smartest movie about writing ever made. I may be the only person who thinks that. It's at least the smartest movie about writing that I've ever seen. Set in 1941, the film tells the story of a playwright whose Broadway success reluctantly sends him to Hollywood, where he lives in the Hotel Earl, a decaying Art Deco hotel whose rooms seem to come right out of Edward Hopper paintings. Barton finds the transition to screenwriting to be traumatic. He is befriended by a fellow writer who has also found his tenure in Hollywood to be problematic on an extremely alcoholic and codependent level. And Barton is also befriended and helped by a brash salesman who lives in the hotel room next door. When reviewing Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, one critic from GQ or perhaps Esquire, oh my damned memory, bemoaned the message that narratives meant to convey social messages are misguided, the sin that the critic traced back to Barton Fink and the Coen brothers' body of work. Barton Fink is a playwright giving voice to the common man, and ultimately the wisdom of presuming to speak for other people is overturned by the sublime end of the film. Barton Fink, however, is a deeply complex film in which the relationship a writer has to other people is explored, and I think that was the dimension that this critic seemed to either not care about or not see. We romanticize the writer's relationship to the word, to the mechanisms of writing, such as pens, typewriters, and computers. I think of Sarah Jessica Parker's Macintosh laptop in Sex and the City and how that was turned into sort of this totem of writing. While we overlook a writer's relationship to other people, either because it seems self-evident, which if you know writers, that should not seem self-evident at all, or some other thing I don't remember. In the climax of the movie, Barton must confront Charlie Meadows, who turns out to be a much different person than Barton thought. Charlie Meadows is the salesman who lives next door. Charlie's murdered Barton's literary friends and may very well have murdered Barton's family back in New York as well. But Barton must acknowledge, despite all of that, how he misread Charlie because he did not listen, was not empathetic enough to a real working class man, and his drive to empathize with the abstraction of the entire working class. When Barton apologizes to Charlie, he finally becomes a writer bereft of all the certainties that have equipped him to write in the past. And so that's why I think Barton Fink is the smartest movie about writing. He has to empathize basically with a serial killer. But of course, Charlie doesn't seem like a serial killer for at least half the movie. And even as a serial killer, you can see some of his humanity coming through, that just because he's a serial killer does not mean that his friendship to Barton is fake. Just because he's a serial killer doesn't mean that his own humanity does not exist. It would be far more convenient to just say he's a monster, write him off. And Barton Fink, looking him right in the eyes, and his own life is in the balance, but Barton isn't thinking about his life. He's just looking at Charlie and he says, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I didn't listen. Yeah. I thought you had it figured out.
My favorite moment in that whole movie is when Charlie finally says, you didn't listen. His jowls flap.
But Charlie, why me? Why?
Because you don't listen!
Come on, Barton. You think you know pain? You think I made your life hell? Take a look around this dump. You're just a tourist with a typewriter, Barton. I live here. Don't you understand that? And you come into my home and you complain that I'm making too much. much noise.
I think that is a really great moment, turning moment of, obviously it's meant to be, where Barton has his realization. But I do think it's an interesting commentary, not just about the relationship between writers and other people, but about the relationship between what we think of as the real world and writers' imaginations. So there's both of those issues kind of come to a head in that moment. He's imagined all this stuff about the working man, but he doesn't really know anything about him. He didn't bother to actually, you know, go out and get his fingers dirty.
Right. Well, Hollywood seems to be a popular setting for writer movies or even books about writers in general. There is that crossover usually where there's this, you know, shy novelist or quiet novelist, and he comes to Hollywood and all of a sudden he has to talk to a lot of people, and there are all these requirements and all these expectations of the writer to be social, and then there's this pressure because screenplays are produced at a fast pace. So it's very interesting to sort of take the novelist out of his element, in this case Barton Fink, and throw him in there and see how the writer struggles with that.
And there's the assumption that working on a Hollywood picture is easy, and so it requires less of you as a writer, and it kicks their ass. They can't mm-hmm. actually produce works that the powers that be in Hollywood and audiences respond to.
Just having trouble getting started. It's funny, I'm blocked up. I just feel like I need some kind of indication of what's expected.
Wallace Beery, wrestling picture. What do you need, a roadmap? Look, you're confused. You need guidance? Talk to another writer.
Who?
Oh, Jesus. You throw a rock in here, you'll hit one. Do me a favor, Fink. Throw it hard.
One of the things that I love is that the character of William Mayhew is actually a combination of Faulkner and F. Scott Fitzgerald. I love that period. And we're talking about writers who definitely have been romanticized, where if you actually know anything about F. Scott Fitzgerald's life, you do not want his life.
Right.
No. Nor Faulkner's.
Maybe their vision, but you don't want their life. And actually, Faulkner had a fairly successful career in Hollywood, whereas Fitzgerald was a complete flop. I think two of Fitzgerald's scripts actually made it to the screen. I heard that he touched a version of Gone with the Wind. Who knows if anything he touched actually got into the movie? Whereas Faulkner actually wrote things that did find their way on the screen, yes. Including a pretty good adaptation of Hemingway's To Have and Have Not, starring Bogey and Bacall. The character of Mayhew is, even though he wears the trappings of Faulkner, quite clearly he looks like Faulkner, he sounds like Faulkner, but, you know, he's Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. And his own scripts are ridiculously bad. And so I think that was pretty funny, even while at the same time they are romanticizing the writer. Oh, he's a hard drinker. He's a tortured, beautiful soul.
Right. And I think one of the things to connect to what Yaroslav said about, you know, them going to Hollywood and finding this completely other world is a really good kind of condensation of what writers encounter across the board. It's not always so intense and obvious, perhaps, as it is in Hollywood, but that whole kind of, you know, thinking about selling your work, which most writers, not a place most writers start, you know,
right.
And yet it's a place where most anybody, an editor or an agent or a producer, always is going to end up. And so there's that confrontation with that Barton Fink has, that's a really good kind of overview of that process.
And he's just wonderfully bad at it. And one of my favorite scenes, although kind of like O Brother, Where Art Thou, like every scene is my favorite scene, when he first meets the studio mogul who has a motor mouth, and there's a moment where in the middle of one of his long rants, he asks Barton if he wants coffee, and there's like a good 10-second pause while Barton actually is processing the information, because his metabolism, his energy is so much slower than that of Lipnick's.
Yep. Yep. True.
Naked Lunch, 1991, by David Cronenberg, I think also there are so many ways to look at that movie. And I should confess, by the way, it's adapted from the novel by William S. Burroughs, vaguely kind of. It's really a mashup of, it's a psychobiographic reading, actually, of William S. Burroughs' composition of Naked Lunch. And so it's really more about the writing of Naked Lunch, using some of Naked Lunch as objective correlatives in a way to sort of make it allegorical. And frankly, better to watch than to read as experiences. And I say that with affection for William S. Burroughs, but the novel's kind of a mess, whereas the movie is messy, but finds really important ways to cohere. You have to watch, you have to be careful, and you need a strong stomach, but I think it does cohere. One of the things that I think is so important is not the drugs, don't do drugs, kids, not the romance of writing, although they did find a pretty interesting way to make the process of writing look interesting on screen. When you're typing into a bug's stomach or an alien's mouth, then yes, okay, it's more interesting than a frumpy white guy sitting in a chair clicking away at the keys, especially when the creatures start talking to him. And one of the things that it does is it calls into question a writer's autonomy, that it's the genius just sitting there composing, and instead it's more all these outside influences from the world. And, you know, there's one of the reports that William Lee, the William S. Burroughs character, has to write is being dictated to him by his typewriter. I think that hopefully de-romanticizes the writer a little bit. But similar to the message in Barton Fink, they both came out the same year, and they both star Judy Davis. And I'm not sure why. They're both period pictures from the same decade. And it really just locked in to the way I approach these films, because the ending of Naked Lunch, right, he's trying to leave Interzone and enter Annexia, I think was the name the land where he was traveling to, this passage back essentially into the world of realism, the world of real things and not talking bugs. And in order to gain passage, they want to see his papers, and they say, what is your occupation? And he says, writer. And they say, prove it. And he says, I have a pen. And he pulls out a pen, and they say, that's not good enough. And he has to murder his wife all over again and live with it, because that's what it meant to be a writer, that simply having a pen, having the ability to write things down, isn't intrinsically meaningful. The ability to accept responsibility.
Or the ability to kill another person for the sake of your art, which I think is one of the messages of that film that I object to a little bit. But
maybe, you know, it means more sacrifice relationships, personal relationships, yeah, rather than actually kill them.
If it's a symbolic death.
Well, there's... Well, if you want to get into the actual story, there's a lot of controversy there. The story goes something like this. Burroughs, his wife, and one of their buddies, it wasn't Allen Ginsberg, although it's the Ginsberg character who's present for it here, because why? It's dramatically more convenient. Mm-hmm. It was one of his friends who did not become a famous writer. They were drinking through the night. They had all these empty bottles laying around. And William Burroughs, who was a marksman, but quite drunk, and he was a gay man who was married to a woman who intensely loved him, who he could never love enough. And so they play this stupid parlor trick game with the highest of possible stakes, and he loses. And he spent his entire life not knowing if he shot her because he was drunk or if he shot her because he wanted to. He actually had an exorcism, like when he was really, really old, because he felt he was inhabited by a bad spirit, maybe like Jim Morrison, although I think Jim Morrison didn't regard it as a bad spirit. But, you know, he did feel like he was not entirely himself. Mm-hmm. And so I think the way that David Cronenberg framed it was a little bit differently. But I think you're talking about the legend that this is what sparked a literary career, that without this, that he would not have become the grand
well
figure.
Known. Yeah, he's well known for saying that he never would have written if he hadn't shot her. It's phrased, from what I recall, in a slippery enough way that you can't tell whether he means that, you know, it was just an instigating thing that he had to grapple with, and therefore that was what turned him toward writing, or whether it's that she would have prevented him, or the relationship would have prevented him from going on and becoming a writer. Hard to say.
Well, the way it's presented in the film, or at least the way his character is presented in the film, is he's very uncommitted to writing.
Right.
There's a scene in the diner where, and I'm going to get their names wrong because I don't care, because I just do the math in my head, the algebra. Okay, that's Jack Kerouac, that's Allen Ginsberg, and right. They're in the diner, and Jack Kerouac is saying, no, you have to just put what you write on the page, that it's your essence, and to revise, to change anything that what you write is a form of censorship, and what you're doing is you're denying freedom, you're denying your own self when you do that. And Ginsberg's saying, no, it's guilt. I need to revise all this stuff. Like, I have to make it the best I can make it. And William Burroughs shows up, and they want him to intermediate in this debate and pick a side. And his answer is exterminate all rational thought. That is a conclusion I have come to. And what's wonderful is Ginsberg moans about this, and he says, well, I'm having a serious conversation here. And Jack Kerouac looks at him, and he goes, so is he. And so I think there was a real ambivalence about the value of writing. Burroughs definitely knew his literature as well as any of the beat writers. He came from a wealthy family and had all the benefits of a fine education. And unlike many of the other writers, he seemed to value these classical sources, although he also valued all kinds of crazy things too. So,
well, what do you all think about the sort of grimness of the vision in Naked Lunch? It certainly isn't any kind of advertisement for becoming a writer. And so I think it's, you mentioned to me before, John, that you were interested in sort of the less romanticized version that is presented in that picture, although it might be romanticized in a certain crazy kind of way, mm-hmm. but it certainly isn't romanticized in an appealing way. And so, to you, that represents a kind of important reality of the writing life or something like that.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the reasons why I followed up your concerns about what we might call the misogyny of the message or the grand narrative of William Burroughs's writing life is I think he was perfectly willing to live in the ambiguity. And if you judged him, that was fine with him. Mm-hmm. And if you hated him, that was fine with him, because he had his mind on weighty matters. And, you know, I'm not sure he could survive. You know, I don't know if he could have a career today and have that point of view. Maybe if he goes on America's Got Talent and just confused everybody. But I really don't think that, you know, and if it wasn't for Naked Lunch actually being the scandalous banned book that it was, I'm also not sure he would have had the career that he had, because, you know, it's compared to Ulysses. It's on that list of you know, all the banned books. And Ulysses, for all of its challenges, is a very well put together book. Psychotic, and at some points the book is out to kill you. But Naked Lunch, what we're getting is fragments from someone's mind who is fairly destroyed.
Right. There's the question whether Naked Lunch, the novel, actually succeeds at anything that it sets out to do, if it sets out to do anything in the first place, other than shock people, which it does quite well. But beyond that, I don't want to call it shallow, but that is maybe something to be considered.
Well, its relationship with the reader is weak, I think. Mm-hmm.
And so for the film to succeed, then it was necessary to connect it to the writer and to the story surrounding the writer's life, which might be more interesting than the actual novel.
Okay, in stark contrast to the craziness and the over-the-top imagination of Naked Lunch as a spectacle, we could compare that with The Stone Reader, which was your choice, Lisa. So I'll let you introduce the listeners to that film and hear your thoughts on it. And I know that you asked what I thought, and I told you you'd have to wait until now. So.
Right. So I'm on pins and needles.
In a few minutes, you will hear what I think.
But. Well, it's also, I want to point out, the only documentary in the bunch here. And so it does have a kind of unusual point that it turns from. But one of the things I like about it, and The Stone Reader, not as well known as some of these other films, is a documentary made by a guy who had started to read a book. He'd read a review of a book when he was very young, just in going into college or graduating from college. I don't remember exactly, but he hadn't ever finished it. And then one day he found it. He still had the book lying around in a corner somewhere. And so he decided to read it, and he loved it. He thought it was great. And so he thought, oh, I have to find anything else that this author has written. And he couldn't find anything. There was nothing. And so he set out on this journey to find out what had happened to this writer and why he hadn't published any more books. He talks to a bunch of different people along the way, English professors and reviewers, and none of them know what happened to this person. Eventually, he does find the writer. I told Yaroslav it's a little bit of an old person's movie, because it's very much about this process of looking back and thinking about what you read when you were younger, what you want to read now, what happens over the trajectory of years, because, you know, the film is also about the filmmaker who has had changes in his life. And so there's this sort of sense of time spreading out and how quickly it spreads out and departs from you. But I think some of the things I really enjoyed about it were the sort of connectedness of reading and writing, and the way that all writers are readers, and yet not all readers are writers. And so there was a really interesting way in which the filmmaker could not imagine what would have happened to this guy and why he would have quit publishing novels. He was so naive. You love him. and he has this sort of journey.
I don't know if he's that naive. Dal Mossman's The Stones of Summer received a glowing review on page 4 of the New York Times review section.
Right.
So there was reason to believe that he should have had a career. So that's not... It's a little naive, but it's not quite so naive.
Well, I don't mean to criticize him for it. It was something about his personality that I enjoyed, that his yes. sense that, you know, this person had so much talent and was an interesting writer. So, you know, what happened? I mean, just the question. I think the question, once you've been an artist, is how does anyone keep going? And so there's a different perspective there. That's all. I don't mean to criticize them for being naive.
Well, I think what you're responding to is the gulf between being a writer and being just a reader.
Right.
Because when we read a book, even when we love it, part of us is dissecting it and saying, you know, oh, I would have done this better, or, well, I couldn't have done that. Wow, that's really good. I don't even need to try and copy that, because I couldn't come near whatever it is that's going on over there. But books that are like what we might write, we are always judging ourselves against it. And so there's, you know, at least some degree of cynicism to our reading habits, whereas to our reader who isn't competing with the writers, there's an earnestness there that I think it's shocking in its purity. And mm-hmm. I think, mm-hmm. you know, this guy loves books, and he's just on camera talking about how he loves books, and you keep expecting him, yeah, to just be a jerk or be snarky, and instead he really loved this one book that it took him 20 years or so to actually get around to reading.
Yeah.
Which is also, I think, frightening to writers also. Like, we want him to be a jerk, because is it going to take 20 years for someone to read a book if we publish it this year? I don't want to think about that. I really don't want to think about that.
Mm-hmm. They're sort of timeless objects for readers, and for us, they're not. There's something that, and I mean, I still occasionally encounter this. You know, my memoir was published a while back, and I will still meet people or occasionally get an email from a person who thinks that that's the now of my life. Like, whoa, no,
because it's the now of their life.
Because it's the now right. they just read, you know, and so there's that timelessness of the book in other people's lives, but not in the life of a writer. You know, not in the life of Dal Mossman, who did not write more books. Could not write more books.
Or at least not in those intervening years.
Right.
Because it turns out that The Stones of Summer broke him.
Yes.
Which is bad enough, but also his publisher was a little bit obscure. And so not only did writing the book break him, but the book did not keep going on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Although, based on the strength of the documentary, they did come out with a new version, which I believe is also now on its way to being out of print. I don't think they're printing new copies, but you could still kind of get plenty of old copies online. Have you read The Stones of Summer?
I have not read it.
Oh.
I've bought it, but I haven't read it yet. It's on my huge pile of things to read.
Is it a novel or is it a memoir?
It's a novel.
It's a novel. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Apparently, it's one of those postmodern mammoths that are meant to destroy your life.
All right.
I don't know if it's quite as big and scary as Gravity's Rainbow or Infinite Jest, but it is sort of one of those very thick. And that was one of the things that was a little bit surprising is this was his first novel and it was huge. And when you hear him, they finally track him down. Mark Moskowitz, the director, tracks him down towards the end of the film. And he said, oh, I wasn't done with the book. They took it away from me. Which also I found, considering that the guy was a little bit nutty when they met him in the documentary, and hearing him say that, I just imagine some sort of Borges nightmare where a writer is left with a manuscript and that relationship to the manuscript never ends.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I find, in no way do I find that romantically charming. I find that hideous.
No. And one of the reasons why I like that film so much too was that that it's utterly unromantic. And maybe it's too unromantic, I don't know. But I was watching all these movies for the development of this course that Yaroslav took a couple of years ago about writers. And we looked at quite a few movies about writers. And developing in the course for me was part of a response to the number of students that would come into my creative writing classroom with these sort of strange ideas about... they were different from each other. Some people's strange ideas were that they were gonna, you know, that it was sex, drugs, and writing. And for some people, it was, you know, much more of a sort of a Beatrix Potter kind of romanticism. But I didn't feel like they had any kind of sense of what it actually meant and the various consequences that there could be for being a writer, or why we might have developed these romantic notions. And so I didn't use this film with the course. It was too vulnerable. but I just, for me, it was a huge relief when I saw it. It was a huge relief. It was like, oh, it isn't all, you know, sex and drugs and typewriters, and it isn't all, you know, teacups. It's, you know, here's someone who sacrificed his life on the altar of this one novel that he wrote and maybe never felt that he had finished, and that broke him. It's pretty sad. It was sad, but that kind of thing can happen.
Well, and he didn't sound like a writer at the end of the movie. He's like, you know, oh, I've read your book and I want to come talk to you. And he's like, oh, really? That's, that's funny. And it's just 9 years as a welder, and he was working for a newspaper, tying up newspapers at night.
Yeah.
Do you think it could be that since he was never really immersed in a literary culture, per se, he didn't hang out with academics, you know?
But he was.
Oh, he was.
Oh, he was, really?
He came out of Iowa. Okay.
He came out of Iowa.
Oh, I see.
Uh-huh.
He had friends in high places and fellow writers who...
Well, I think it also connected to Ted Solotaroff's essay, Writing in the Cold, which is about his years as an editor of literary magazines and how he would see young writers come into the literary magazine publishing world and, you know, with vast amounts of talent, and then they would disappear. And so there are a lot of people who start down the path and don't stay on the path. Mm-hmm. And I think we all have that question about how do you stay on the path? And again, from a reader's point of view, it might be, well, how could you not if you have that much talent and ability? But for many people, it's not that easy to stay on that path. There are many things that interfere with it.
Right.
Even if you are at Iowa and you know, a highly talented person.
Or NYU. I found it really smart editing towards the end because the interviews with Dal Mossman at the end are intercut with an interview with Dal Mossman's agent from the early 70s. And the agent's expressions, at first very civilized and kind of serious, and you could just see him melting slowly, sort of watching, you know, he brought footage of the Dow Mossman interviews, and also, you know, he was just shocked that this is what happens to a great writer. You know, I found that agent more moving than actually talking to Dow Mossman, mm-hmm. who was energetic and happy, but what this agent had to say, and the look on that agent's face. You know, we think that agents don't necessarily care. This is an agent who, yeah, he wasn't Dal Mossman's friend. He was a business associate, but he cared. And I think that's the great gift of this movie, is it really does show you the full spectrum of the business of writing, and not simply the writer in isolation living a crazy life, but mm-hmm. rather, and Dal Mossman did live a crazy life, and yeah, it was not fun. He was institutionalized. That's what crazy very often leads to. It's not... It's not right. only Hunter S. Thompson, which is a glorious kind of crazy, but it's also...
One of the crazy people that was in my MFA program went to jail, you know. He launched down a path of behavior that was unacceptable and went to jail. And for him, it was all part of the sort of writer's experience. and he did a lot of drugs that eventually eroded his sanity, and... I don't know if he's out of jail by now, but he went to jail. So that happens.
Well, Hunter Thompson said drugs and alcohol and crazy behavior. He said, it, you know, it doesn't work for everybody, but in his case, it worked out. And it's a very funny quip, but he's actually, I think, deadly serious. You know, he's not saying don't. He has no foundation to say don't do anything you don't want to do, because he's pretty much done everything he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But... I think people forget that first part, you know, that it's not going to work for most people. 99.99, it'll work for Keith Richards. It'll work for a handful of people. Most people can't keep it together with that. And we could argue about whether ultimately he did keep it together, but we're not going to have that argument today. Moving right along, the most romanticized writer in history, Shakespeare, was the subject of a fictional treatment in John Madden's Shakespeare in Love, 1998. The screenplay was by Mark Norman with a hell of an assist from Tom Stoppard. I don't know if there's a lot to talk about here.
I don't have much to say about it. It's a pretty movie.
It's a romance, as one would expect from a movie about Shakespeare in love. I can't really think
what
of
it,
much.
What does it tell you about being a writer? What does Shakespeare in Love tell us about being a writer?
Well, among other things, what it does is it takes Shakespeare down several notches, or at least maybe several hundred notches. People think Shakespeare is perfect, which is egregious bullshit. He is not perfect. He is miraculous, but he is not perfect.
Right.
And this imaginative way of looking at his composition of Romeo and Juliet, you know, he hasn't figured the title out and he hasn't figured the plot out, and he keeps getting suggestions from everywhere in this movie. So the idea is Shakespeare's mind was this godlike power that just poured forth these perfect plays. If you've read the plays, you know they're not perfect. The first thing that anyone does when they want to mount a production of Shakespeare is start cutting. You have to decide what your version of this play is going to be like, because otherwise you're there for 4 hours. I don't like doing anything I even like for 4 hours in a row. Not even Shakespeare. Or at least not one play by Shakespeare. 4 hours for two? All right, I could maybe go for that. But one, nah, I don't think so. So for me, that was the valuable thing, is letting you know, oh, well, Shakespeare wasn't perfect. And he probably had a lot of help along the way, or at least a lot of nudges. And hearing words come out of actors' mouth, okay, maybe you changed that. I do remember Dal Mossman getting really upset at the movie. He said, well, Shakespeare didn't have paper, and he certainly wasn't throwing paper away, which may be very true.
Yeah.
But I also think that Shakespeare in Love simultaneously romanticizes Shakespeare, but also humanizes him, that it makes him a really good writer and not a god, which is, I think, considering his exalted status in the literary canon, considering that, as many people suggest, he invented modern psychology. He's told so many stories, and really, you can't presume to be a knowledgeable writer and not be pretty familiar with at least a dozen of his plays.
Well, I actually think that's a really great point, because what it indicates, I mean, if a movie as romanticized as Shakespeare in Love can actually be a step toward realism That's hilarious. And it lets us know a lot about the way that writers are viewed in general, particularly historical figures. I think that's a great point.
So I guess it takes us to a frequent question from writing students is, where do you get your ideas from? I love that question.
I get mine from a pelican named Clarence.
That's a good
gives
answer.
Gives me all of my
I
ideas.
Like it. But so I guess what you're saying is, we suggest that indeed ideas come from observation and from the writer's environment rather than there being some miraculous place in the writer's head or God pouring them into the writer's head.
Yeah, there's no muse transmitting perfect radio transmissions into your brain with perfect compositions, or at least not often.
Not often. I've gotten a gift once or twice, but it's not the way it normally works.
Right.
Yeah. No, it comes from being attuned to the world around you and the possibilities on the page. But, you know, Shakespeare's a literary kleptomaniac in this play. And the other great thing is he's always chasing after money. He's a money grubber in this movie, which I think is also refreshing.
There is no dog in the first scene, Mr. Kemp. Thank you.
How goes it, Will?
I'm still owed money for this play, Burbage.
Not by me. I only stole it. My sleeve wants for the button, Mistress Rosaline. Where were my seamstress's eyes? When are you coming over to the Chamberlain's men?
When I have £50.
You writing?
A comedy. All but done.
Pirate comedy. Wonderful. Bring it tomorrow.
It's for Henslow. He paid me.
How much?
£10.
You're a liar.
I swear he wants Romeo for Ned and the Admiral's men.
Ned's wrong for it.
Will!
Here's 2 sovereigns. I'll give you another 2 when I see the pages.
Done.
Burbage, I will see you hanged for a pickpocket.
Shakespeare isn't above earning a living. That, in fact, he was the James Cameron, George Lucas of his day.
Absolutely. That is a great point.
So
I can't fully accept that comparison, but I know what you mean.
He was the creator of blockbusters of his day.
Yes, yes.
Adjusted for inflation.
Adjusted for inflation.
I hope that people won't still be reading James Cameron hundreds of years from now. But they probably will. I don't know.
I don't think anybody even remembers what Avatar is anymore. So I think we're good.
We're safe.
We're covered. Okay. Yes.
So let's hasten onward then to 2 films. One came out in 2005, Capote, directed by Bennett Miller. And it's based on Gerard Clark's biography, in which new research about the composition of Capote's masterpiece of creative nonfiction, In Cold Blood, came out. And Infamous, directed by Douglas McGrath, and it claims to be based on George Plimpton's biography of Capote, which is true to some degree, but it also seems like it's leaning really heavily on the new information that came out about how close and implicated he was to the 2 convicts that he was writing about.
Right.
And these were your choices, Lisa. So again,
you'll turn to me. Well,
put the ball in your court.
Capote is a film that I've used with creative nonfiction students to start a conversation about literary journalism. At the undergraduate level, often in discussions of creative nonfiction, we focus so heavily on memoir that students don't get a full sense of what the options are. And so Capote is something I've shown to students to say, well, you can go somewhere else with creative nonfiction or with the sense of nonfiction and think about the ways in which you can take quote-unquote, a real story, and make it your own with as much creative juice as any novel. And so that's how I first kind of got familiar with Capote, more so than Infamous, although I think they're both great movies. But Capote came out first, and that was why I was on it first. But at any rate, I think that they show a different kind of sacrifice. It's not a sacrifice so much of a personal relationship, although that certainly does happen in both of those films. Capote's, wrangling with his partner about his absences, but the sort of way in which the place that the work takes him is dark enough that it's a very, very difficult place for him to go. And at the end of Capote, for instance, what he's really, really waiting for is for his friend, the criminal, to die on the gallows because he can't finish the book otherwise. And that's a very, you know, succinct summary of how you can, when you're working on research-based creative writing, be at someone else's mercy. And in fact, you know, one of the questions I like to pose about that is, what would happen if the guy had gotten a permanent stay of execution? What would have happened to In Cold Blood? Hard to say, but, you know, there are certain kinds of risks involved with that kind of writing, and one of them is that it may never turn into a story that has an end, which can be tough writing. That's what I, my connection to the film, so.
You know, I think I interpreted the end differently. You know, he says, you know, I need him to die, like, he has to die. In part because he found the relationship unbearable.
Yeah,
because he was a friend to this man, friend and lover of some kind. And also, I don't know that I buy your premise that he needed to die for the book to end. Writers, we make shit up all the time. We are allowed to make shit up all the time. You can create a resonant ending without this man dying. Although the risk you run is, of course, you would need that permanent stay of execution.
It would need to be permanent.
And I don't know how that happens unless the state says no more executions.
Right.
But
that's the permanence is the issue. It's like if you're going to put the end on this book and then, you know, a month later.
He's executed.
Executed.
That ruins your
problem.
Book.
Yeah.
But so I could see that. But and there's something just so honest about Capote's callousness.
Yes.
And his inability to process all the different roles that he has to play there, friend, lover, adulterer.
But there's that great scene in the prison where he says, you know, don't get me wrong. The only reason I'm coming here is because I want this story. And if you don't tell me this story, nobody's ever going to hear it. They're just going to think you're a monster. And so, you know, get with the program or you know, I'm not doing this anymore. Mm-hmm. So he has that very, very rough confrontation that is that kind of ruthlessness, the writer's ruthlessness.
I would say throughout the film, he's definitely always more of a writer than he is a friend to anyone.
Yes, absolutely.
It's always about the work, about getting it done. And his friendships suffer because of that. He's not a very likable person in the film.
No.
Well, I felt that Philip Seymour Hoffman's portrayal was less sympathetic than, I forget the name of the actor, which is terrible because he did a fine job. I almost wish I could see the other actor in Capote and switch them up that way. Although I did like a lot of the sort of interview, they had it set up where they had fake documentary interviews, and I thought those were really effective. But it seems like his inability to, you know, yes, he was the ruthless writer, and he could be callous, and he could be forceful. And ultimately, after writing this book, he really didn't write anything else. That was the end of his career.
He wrote, but it wasn't.
He dabbled.
Of the same. It wasn't of the same caliber.
Or anything close.
Right.
You know, he just retired into becoming a caricature of himself, which is a real danger if you actually do manage to acquire a powerful ethos that catches in the public imagination, is that you run around basically doing Halloween tricks as yourself rather than evolving and progressing. And I think, you know, that's a concern that a lot of writers actually do have. They're very private people, and they put their stuff out in the world, and then people want to talk to them, and they're like, well, I'm afraid for you to actually see me, because that means I have an obligation then to be the writer, which carries with it all this cultural baggage, which is why we're talking about all this in the first place.
Well, I think Capote is an infamous too. I think they're both very good examples of depiction of the pitfalls. You know, there are many, many pitfalls, but, you know, they both of those films have the difficulty of relationships with other people, the difficulty of relationships with subject matter, and the difficulty of success if you have success. Every writer hopes for it, but it can clobber you as well, and certainly it did him. And it's hard to say with Capote whether, like, if he had had a huge hit with a different kind of book. I mean, he was a New Yorker staff writer. He'd already done a lot of good stuff. and was well known. But, you know, there was something about that particular, you know, who knows what it was. I mean, we can say it was the subject matter. We can say it was the long, agonizing wait. We can say it was some sort of sense of responsibility that he felt for not trying to stop the executions in the last analysis. So there are lots of things, or that just his alcoholism caught up with him eventually.
That's also possible.
There's that. It didn't work for him the way it did Hunter S. Thompson.
Probably not, no. One of the essential issues is, as writers, it is our job to reveal truth and reality and humanity to levels that we don't see in everyday. Even if our everyday isn't filled with radio and TV and internet advertising, which that's not many people anyway, but we're still living mostly on the surface. We're mostly getting from point A to point B, getting paid, getting our families taken care of. And so most of us don't have much time left over for an interior life or even to contemplate what our lives mean. If our life isn't on fire, oh, I won. But I think what this, in the pursuit of truth, that I think this brings up the stakes of, you really damage your relationships with other people when you write the truth. And I think that's a risk that many writers don't fess up to often enough. And I think this movie is kind of an extreme case of that.
I would just have to agree.
As someone who's written memoir, yeah.
I don't want to do too much personal stuff, but, you know, my husband didn't want to go out with me because he read my memoir.
Wow.
And he said, I don't want to be the next boyfriend that you write about, the next ex-boyfriend that you write about. So it took us a while to get beyond that.
I'm allowed to change names. Well, you are if you say that it's fiction. But we move on to Henry and June, 1990. Directed by Philip Kaufman and based on a book by N.A.S. Nin. One of the interesting things is the story of N.A.S. Nin's relationship with Henry Miller is told from her point of view, which is, I think, one of the saving graces of the film. I'm not sure it says much, actually, about normal life as a writer.
I have not seen it. I cannot speak
to it. What? Well,
how old were you when it came out?
When did it come out?
1990.
Okay. I was 2 years old.
Oh, boy.
Just after the revolution.
Well, your mom wouldn't have wanted you to watch it.
I don't think we had it in my country back then.
I think it was the first NC-17.
I didn't see it at the time, so I hadn't seen it until recently. And there is that great scene where Henry Miller is typing while his roommate has acrobats in the house doing backbends and is screwing them in the middle of the room, and, you know, all kinds of stuff is carrying on around him, and he's just typing. He's just typing and typing and typing on his manuscript of Tropic of Cancer.
And the light changes, and they've kind of cycled
the days go by. And so that's a thing that I guess has an element of truth to it about the writing life, is that, you know, you have to just keep typing.
The ass in the chairness.
The ass in the chairness.
The writing life.
Yeah.
For me, I think that was one of the most, visually interesting, but you could have done that with any writer.
Right.
Or at least any writer who used a typewriter.
Right. Well, Nin is shown writing in her diaries, you know, which is what she was famous for writing. I read most of them in college, her diaries, you know, that were published at the time. And she was wonderful in her own specific sort of oversexed kind of way. In the film, I found her, I mean, I just laughed a lot when I watched it. All of the stuff about her saying, I feel innocent, you know, as soon as she's like cheating on her husband, she feels innocent. And so there was that kind of romanticism of the need for experience of all kinds, and that if you're a writer, you have to just do whatever you want to do, and that you're innocent in doing whatever you want to do. And I'm just like, oh, that's just, oh.
It's a good excuse.
Yeah. It works for a lot of people.
Yeah. But. Well, and when he's clambering around going, Pussy Willow, you have to cheat on that man. You have to cheat on that man. I think it says more about bohemian life than necessarily a writing life.
Yes.
And I do think it, you know, it's a meditation on exploring more extreme experiences. I'm not sure ultimately it has much to say other than, pull back before you ruin everything.
One other thing that I thought was interesting about the film was the way in which the character of June was transmogrified over the film, because in her first appearance, she is seen as this sort of all-powerful, fabulously sexy, completely brilliant, beautiful person.
Played by Uma Thurman,
who is all of those things. And then by the end, you see her come back and she becomes this sort of object of pity, and she's desperate and pathetic. And it was actually such a huge transition in her character, and it's obviously how Nin is seeing her, you know, what Nin is seeing in her. I thought that that was one thing that the film did really well, was show that kind of ability of a writer to get caught up in something and view it in a particular way that might or might not have any relationship to what other people might see. So that was the kind of... They did a really good job with the Nin lens on everything. It was a rose-colored lens at first, and then later it turned kind of yellow, you know.
Of course, when she sees June at the end of the film, this is after she's had her relationship.
Right.
This is after Nin has had a relationship with Miller, which, as she found out, as most people, well, cynical, wise people like us might agree, better to rent than to own Henry Miller as a person. You know, charming, wonderful, funny. I'm not sure you want to live with that. Vacation with that, fine. Live with that, I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
Quills. Uh-oh.
I'm sorry. I only get an hour today.
All right, so apparently, Yaroslav, you have to run off.
I do. Back to building America.
Well, who am I to interfere with that? All right. We will have to have, what is that platonic term for when you have to end a debate before you're over?
I don't know.
Premature interjection? No.
No, that's not a
coitus interruptus.
There you go.
I don't want you to say that.
Well, it'll be coitus interruptus then, listeners, and we will finish our discussion on a future episode. So look forward to part two soon.
Addendum. The word I was seeking was aporia, A-P-O-R-I-A. Apparently it means something more like a perplexity than merely an interruption, although a perplexity often does feel like an interruption, doesn't it? Toby Jones is the name of the actor who played Capote in Infamous. My apologies to Mr. Jones.
And now, a book discussion. A book that saved my life.
Muses, Mentors, and Dangerous Angels. Imagine you are a 13-year-old girl living in a small suburban town just north of Boston. Your parents are strict. There is no cable at home and no MTV. Your mom listens to John Denver and Simon and Garfunkel and Fleetwood Mac, so you do as well. Your little brothers are still asking you to play G.I. Joes with them. You are restless, ready for the adventures of these much-anticipated teenage years. The library is your refuge, your escape. It's walking distance from home, and every day, after school, you spend your free time in the stacks. That's where you discover Francesca Leah Block's Dangerous Angels. I often wonder if I would react to this classic young adult novel, or to be exact, collection of five novellas, the same way if I stumbled upon it today. Of course, it's impossible to say. All I know is that Block's work, and this book in particular, entered my life at just the right time. I had found what I didn't even know I was looking for. In Dangerous Angels, the main character, Wheatsy Bat, has three wishes: to find a duck for her best friend, Dirk, a secret agent lover man for herself, and a house for them all to live. A genie appears, and the story unfolds. Dangerous Angels is a postmodern fairy tale set in a near-mythical Los Angeles. It is at once subversive and dark, while it is shimmery, glittery, and sweet enough to make your molars ache. The details are lush, sensual, original, and sometimes strange, a rubber chicken, a globe lamp, and cowboy boot roller skates all play an important role. But, like all good literary fiction, it is the characters that shine and the characters that stay with the reader. Snarly, angry, purple-eyed witch baby, sweet, barefoot and blonde Cherokee bat, Angel Wan, Raphael Changja Love. Even at a time in my life when I was very much figuring out my identity and deciding who and what I wanted to become, it wasn't so much that I wanted to emulate Block's characters, but rather I recognized parts of myself in them. In the words of Sylvia Plath, I was learning to be true to my own weirdnesses. Block does not shield her young readers from the world, and her work is frequently included on the ALA's most banned or challenged book lists. Baby Bebop, the fifth installment in Dangerous Angels, which features a gay teenager, was publicly burned in 2009 in West Bend, Wisconsin, when parent groups complained to the local library and advocated for its removal. I owe a lot to the librarians who kept works like Block's on the shelf in the town where I grew up. I most certainly wouldn't be where I am today if they hadn't. You see, Dangerous Angels did more than show me the darkness that exists while giving me the courage to face it, and to not only expect but demand love and magic from life. Dangerous Angels was my first love affair with words. I read and reread and reread. I copied sentences. I wanted to learn how to make something so beautiful, so important. Block's books were, for me, a gateway drug to magic realism, to writers like Borges and Gabriel Garcia Marquez. They were my intro course to Greek mythology, the Brothers Grimm, and Hans Christian Andersen. And, later, to writers Kelly Link, Amelia Gray, Amy Bender, and Judy Butnitz, to name only a few. It was because of Dangerous Angels that, at 18, I traveled out of the country for the first time to study with Block during a one-week writing conference in Toronto, and then traveled again, after completing my BFA in creative writing at Emerson College, across the country to mythical LA itself, to sit on the pink couch in her fairy cottage and hear her say, "You can do this. You can be a writer." It is because of Dangerous Angels that when I was paired with the surrealist, fabulous writer Lori Foos in my MFA program at Lesley University, I didn't look at her books about a woman losing her uterus in a mall, or a beautician with Elvis-obsessed parents who sprouts a horn from the center of her forehead and think, "What the..." I thought, "What luck?" My own writing, maybe surprisingly, leans toward autobiographical realism. Dangerous Angels reminds this realist she has an imagination. At 13, it was the book that saved my life. Today, it remains my lifeblood, an entry into the writing world. Writing takes what Weetzie Bat has: love, determination, a few great friends, a good amount of pluckiness, and the will to stay true to oneself. Be brave. There is no light without the dark.
And now, the Drunken Odyssey mailbag.
Right now, we are listening to the sonic explorations of the Tikiaki Orchestra. They are the best exotica music group out there, in my considerable opinion on these matters. The grooves and tremolos, the bending and slithering of swank notes, the bird calls take my mind off the clock and float me to the exotic kingdom of the id I leave behind my eyes when I wake up and face the day. All right, Keith Clavin wants to know approximately how many pints of beer could Hemingway consume in one night? And he somehow wants the answer converted to 2010 pints. I'm afraid I don't know the answer to this. I don't drink beer. And so I don't know if, I don't know, is beer diluted now or is it more intensified now? I really don't know. I don't like beer. It feels like I'm drinking a loaf of bread that has been somehow stuck in a blender. Not fond of it. Not quite so bad as what's happening to vodka right now. No one should try and make vodka taste like marshmallows. And so, besides the conversion problem, I don't know much about Hemingway's drinking beer. You know, he seemed to be an aficionado of all kinds of drinking, but when it came to beer, nothing in my mind really sticks out. I know that he did shill for Ballantine Ale in a magazine ad in a really, really, really embarrassing way. It's a letter that he wrote to the Ballantine Company in which he describes how wonderful a cold Ballantine ale is after catching a fish. And basically he makes it sound like the old man in the sea with a happier ending, an ending perfectly topped off with a Ballantine ale. Ick. Ryan Rivas, who was on episode 1, asks, if Hemingway and Wallace Stevens got in a fight, well, yes, they did get into a fight. It lasted one punch long. Ryan didn't actually finish the question, though. So if Hemingway and Wallace Stevens got into a fight, if what he's trying to ask is how many Wallace Stevens would it take to defeat Hemingway, the answer is 3,072. If you had 3,072 Wallace Stevens, they could defeat Ernest Hemingway in a fistfight. Yaroslav wrote in and asks, how much whiskey does a writer need to break his own face? I'm afraid you know the answer better than I do on that one. The good news for me is I have a body a little bit like Hemingway's, and so it takes a lot for me to become incapacitated. Drink carefully in New York, my friend. Adam Gottway wants to know, let's see, perhaps you could share your opinion on the influence of text messaging and social media on the younger generation's ability, or lack thereof, to communicate in writing. KKTHXLaw. Very funny, Adam. So, I am a composition teacher here at the University of Central Florida, and I've been teaching composition now for a very, very long time. Since 1993. More or less continuously. And I'm not convinced that students are getting less bright or less literate. That is not my actual experience. Here at the University of Central Florida, we have students who are not remarkably above the national average, maybe, you know, slightly above average, but our students are good kids, average kids, and what we demand of them here at the University of Central Florida is that they behave like scholars and write and read like scholars. It's the most ambitious program I've taught in, and I've taught in many, many places. So I have no worries about the future of literacy in America based on whatever impact we might imagine that social media and text messaging might have. Having said that, I do have some concerns about what it means socially, which is to say, you know, I can't regard a telephone as a friend. I can't regard Facebook as the world. I just can't. I do like Facebook, and it's a helpful way for me to keep track of friends who I don't get to see. My many years of going to school in different places have made me have a large number of friends who are spread out all over the country, not all over the world, but it goes outside just this country. And so it's pretty wonderful that, you know, I can sort of keep touch with them in an easier way. But the way my students seem to function socially is that their phones are only slightly less important than breathing. I also find it strange to go to the movies and see people texting during the movie. Why go to the movies if you're going to just write to someone else? And I am easily distracted by the glowing screens of this stuff. So going to the movies, going to concerts, going to shows is almost completely ruled out for me, with the exception of theater, which goes out of its way to try and encourage people not to do that. Well, that's all the show we've got for this week. If you want to write in with questions of your own, please do so at thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com. Also, if you're fond of the show, you could do me one really, really big favor, and that is just spread the word to any other writer friends you have out there who might enjoy the show. All right, keep your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.
Is that him? Is that Barton Fink? Let me at him. Let me put my arms around this guy. Let me hunt this guy. How the hell are you?
Good trip. My name is Jack Litton. I run this stop. You know that. You read the papers. Lou treat me all right? Get everything you need?
What the hell's the matter with your face?
What the hell's the matter with his face, Lou?
Not as bad as the book. I'm just, you know, whatever.
Place okay? Leave the book.
I'm at the Earl.
Never heard of it. Let's move him to the Grand or the Wilshire. Hell, he can stay in my place.
Thanks, but I wanted a place that was a little
less... Less Hollywood. Sure, say it. It's not a dirty word. Say whatever the hell you want. The writer is king here at Capitol Pictures. You don't believe me? Take a look at your paycheck at the end of every week. That's what we think of the writer. So what kind of pictures does he like?
Mr. Fink hasn't given a preference, Mr. Lipnick.
So how about it, Bart?
Well, to be honest, I don't go to the pictures much, Mr. Lipnick.
That's okay. That's okay. That's okay. That's just fine. You probably walked in here thinking that was going to be a handicap, thinking that we wanted people who knew something about the media, maybe even thinking there was all kinds of technical mumbo-jumbo to learn. You were dead wrong. We're only interested in one thing. Can you tell a story, Bart? Can you make us laugh? Can you make us cry? Can you make us want to break out? Enjoy a song. Is that more than one thing? Okay. The point is, I run this dump, and I don't know the technical mumbo-jumbo. Why do I run it? It's like a horse sense, goddammit. Showmanship! And also, and I hope Lou told you this, I am bigger and meaner and louder than any other kike in this town. Did you tell him that, Lou? And I don't mean my dick is bigger than yours. It's not a sexual thing, although you're the writer, you know more about that. Coffee?
Yes, thank you.